Hello, and welcome to Barks Remarks, the podcast where we talk about the stories from the legendary Carl Barks, creator of Scrooge McDuck and writer and artist of the greatest Donald and Scrooge comics of all time. Join us as we explore his longer adventure stories in their chronological publishing order. We'll talk about what makes them so enduring, their historical context, and how well they hold up today. So get out your reprint and get ready to enjoy our remarks. Welcome back to Barks Remarks. I'm Mark Severino, a grown man who enjoys duck comics. I've got a returning guest host with me. Austin, do you want to introduce yourself? And could you also tell us if you, like so many kids, had a Greek mythology phase?
Sure. Austin Kelly. Yeah, I've been on here a couple times. It's always a pleasure because, of course, there's nothing better in the world than talking about a good Donald Duck or Uncle Scrooge comic book story. Greek mythology, I was never big into it, but I remember as a kid thinking like, wow, this is like, some of it gets really scary, you know. I remember the one story about the guy who has to push the rock up the hill for like all eternity. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Oh yeah, Sisyphus.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Sisyphus. So I was vaguely familiar with all of it, but it wasn't until I got into the Carl Barks comics that I really started to like properly educate myself on that sort of stuff, you know.
Yeah, I mean, Barks, that's one of the great things that a lot of people like about Barks is that he really touches a lot on myths from a lot of different cultures. A lot of those Greek myths have really permeated pop culture. I myself definitely had my like Greek mythology phase where I was totally fascinated with it, probably around fifth grade or so. My school, you know, we had a big unit on it. I'm talking, of course, about Greek mythology because today's story that we get to discuss is the Daffy, bonkers, very weird Uncle Scrooge adventure, The Golden Fleecing.
Yeah.
And I don't know, Austin, I'm pretty excited about this one. I feel like this one looms large in Carl Barks' pantheon of stories.
Yeah, I agree that it is very weird. I hadn't read it in a long time, but when I was reading it for this recording, you know, that first half is very big on thrills and its action, and I was really into it. But the whole thing came up halfway about the taste testing, and I was like, this is getting super bizarre, you know, which is good because that's, you know, what Carl Barks does. But it just got very weird. But it is a good kind of weird. And this is also, I think, the second Barks story I ever read after the Ground. So it is sort of a nostalgic one as well.
Yeah, this is like a nostalgic favorite of mine. I read it in Gladstone's album series. And I tended to read those over and over because like I didn't put those in boxes. You know, they're too big for boxes. So they were out on the shelf and they were presented so nicely. So I really read this one quite a bit. And like I said, I was into this story. This is one of the times that I actually knew about kind of the myth and the background of it before reading the Barks story. Usually it was the other way around. But have you ever seen the Ray Harryhausen, the old stop motion Jason and the Argonauts that's pretty famous?
I actually haven't. It sounds very interesting.
Yeah, it's a great one. It's one of the most famous of those like old stop motion monster movies. It has a pretty famous scene with these skeletons rising from the ground. And if you are a stop motion buff, which I am a fan of stop motion animation, Jason the Argonauts is like one of the all-time greats. Harryhausen animated a Hydra with all of its heads interacting. It's really incredible.
Sounds
nice. I was familiar with the story. Of course, they take liberties with it in the movie, and Barks is going to take a lot of liberties with the story of the Golden Fleece. Do you think, Austin, do you have enough of an idea of the contours of the old myth to like sum it up, or would you rather I do it?
It's probably best you do it. I have kind of a basic understanding, but
yeah, I'd say I've got a pretty rudimentary understanding of it myself. But like basically the Golden Fleece is this mythical hide of a golden ram, a magical ram, and it's what Jason and his Argonauts were going off on a quest to what was like described as the ends of the earth in their famous ship, the Argo. And then there's a lot of extra details about he meets a woman named Medea, who helps him obtain the fleece through some subterfuge. It's a pretty gruesome story. As you mentioned, a lot of the old Greek myths are pretty chilling. There's some nightmare fuel in them.
Yeah, I was looking into the original story with the Argonauts and everything. And I was surprised because it is very peculiar. And of course, as we said, Barks takes a ton of those liberties sort of to make it kid friendly, because after all, Uncle Scrooge was for like a younger audience. But it is still very interesting to see the direction he takes it in. And of course, the first half, a lot of it is directly based on that original myth, and then it kind of gets progressively weirder, which is very cool.
Right. Yeah, this one, I think this one stands out for its oddness in a lot of ways. Let's see. I'm going to cover some of the kind of background around the original printing of it. So the Golden Fleecing was originally published. It had a cover date of December of 55, but I think it was actually early 56. So we're into like the second half of the 50s at this point, Austin. And it feels to me like kind of a transitional story. Do you know, like Barks of the 60s? I feel like he got a little bit daffier in general, a little bit more screwball with some of the stories. So this kind of almost feels like the start of that to me.
Yeah, in a sense, it's like almost like he ran the well dry of like really nice, original, sort of more straightforward mystery adventures like the Four Colored Donalds, like Oldcastle Secret and Ghost of the Grotto. But like later on, he sort of uses the silliness, almost, I don't want to say crutch because that has a negative connotation, but like just to give the stories an interesting kick, right? And it sort of starts with Golden Fleecing and, land beneath the ground. And then it kind of spirals into later on stuff like the Postman story, which everyone hates from the Gold Key Digger.
Right. Yeah, he's definitely going to get into some like pretty kind of high concepts in this upcoming run of stories now that he's out of kind of the first 10 issues of Uncle Scrooge, because we're in Uncle Scrooge number 12 is our issue number here. And so I guess a general correction here. I had mentioned in a previous episode that The Secret of Atlantis was Barks' last 32-pager, but it is actually this one. I was led astray by the fact that if you look it up, Wikipedia tells you that this one was 31 pages, but that's because like they cut out a panel in the original because they wanted to squeeze in the Dell pledge to parents or the Dell promise to parents, I guess, which is like their old, don't come after us comic book authority attempt to remain family friendly.
Sure, because they, of course, they didn't have like that comic book authority seal of approval on the cover that everyone else had at the time.
Right. And this one's got 12 reprints, which is a pretty good number of them. Did you happen to come across some of the information, Austin, about Barks being asked to kind of tone this one down a little bit?
Yeah, I found a little interesting fact about some panels halfway through the story when Donald and Scrooge get captured by the Larkies, him having to redraw some of the panels because they originally suggested what the editors called insanity, which I
Right.
found like really interesting. And of course, like the I'm sure you know about changing the name of the Harpies to the Larkies.
Yes, exactly. Why are we calling them the Larkies, Austin, instead of as in the Greek myths, the Harpies are the bird-like women creatures that menace. So they menace a man named Phineas in the original myth. They're like his punishment. But why are we calling them Larkies instead?
Far as I could tell, I think what Barks said was Harpy had like a really bad connotation. It's what Barks called a street walker, which I'm pretty sure
Right.
is like a prostitute, right? So,
Yes. Yeah, Barks' actual quote is pretty good because it sounds very like Barksian. He said, "I almost had to eat those 32 pages of drawings. It seems that Harpy is an obscure nickname for a streetwalker, and I managed to save the story by renaming them Larkies instead." And the name is pretty important, and it's important that he was able to come up with something for the little gimmick that he's gonna use later on.
Sure.
Yeah, so like we could spend a lot of time kind of recounting the old myths and what he based it on, but it's pretty famous, and I think most people will have at least like a passing familiarity with it. So why don't I mention a few of the international titles, and then we can launch into the story itself.
Sounds good.
Yeah. So I guess the thing with a story like this is that it's based on this myth that is super, super famous. So in general, people translating it for publication in other countries, they all came up with the same title. It's all called, you know, And the Golden Fleece, or In Search of the Golden Fleece, which means, of course, that they kind of miss out on the neat little pun in English that you get from the story, the golden fleecing, because, of course, to fleece someone is to like trick them or to rip someone off. So it's a great Barks title, but it's pretty anodyne when you translate it. So I pulled out Brazilian Portuguese. It is O Velo de Ouro, which is the golden fleece. And then in Finland, I've been avoiding Finland for a while, so I thought I'd cycle back around to it. It is Kultainen Talja, which, so this was interesting. When I plugged it in, Austin, to Google Translate, it gave me the golden pulley. But I'm going to guess that's just Google Translate having a hard time with Finnish.
Yeah, sounds like that.
I'm sure it's the Golden Fleece. And then I will finish with France, where it is À la recherche de la toison d'or, and that is In Search of the Golden Fleece. All right, so let's see. Anything else you want to cover, you wanted to mention before we launch into the story, Austin?
Probably not. I kind of like that all the titles are just kind of the same general thing, but I do feel like I should probably just point out that today I'm using my copy of Scrooge number 12, which is kind of
nice.
Cool
to go. That is cool.
Story. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's in the era when Barks had all of these neat adventure stories, these iconic adventure stories with these like really anonymous gag titles or gag covers.
Yeah, it's very weird because he could have done a lot of more interesting stuff with the covers than just, you know, Scrooge having a time glass filled with gold coins, but, you know.
Right, and I've never, like, really read any reason why. I think this was a Western dictate, but my assumption is that they liked the idea of having these covers that could kind of match for any story that they could reuse as they wanted.
Sure, yeah.
All right, so let's see. We're still pretty early into the Scrooge series. And I guess it's interesting to me, Austin, that he, in the first like run of Uncle Scrooge stories, you know, he seems to have really been thinking about how he can use his new character. You know, Scrooge likes to go on treasure hunts. Scrooge is worried about his money. We had some of the kind of reflective stories that kind of built up Scrooge's mythology. And by this point, you know, we're back in treasure hunt mode. But it's interesting that this story is not like it we're into the myths, and there's usually an explanation for these mythical things, but we're really going to land into these mythological creatures that are literally straight out of the myth. So I do find that interesting. And as we open, it is a classic shot of Scrooge in his bin. We got a half page splash panel, and he is pondering. I imagine here Barks is like, okay, what's something that a rich man might worry about? Maybe he's going to worry about his clothes, because that's what Scrooge is thinking about. He's thinking how it's odd that he's never really had the kind of clothes that suit a man of his station. We get a reference, it's neat here, to having bought his old broadcloth at a rummage sale in Scotland in 1902. That, of course, is going to be one of those details that Don Rosa is going to pluck out for his Life and Times of Scrooge series. And he kind of resolves that he would like to get a special coat made to loaf around in like other rich men. And he decides that he can have it fancier than average because he'll have it made of pure gold. And he holds up a bar from a stack. And I like that he mentions it'll be cheap because he's already got the goal, of course.
Right.
What do you think, Austin? This feels a little bit un-Scrooge-like to kind of be worried about, you know, his appearance. But I like the angle here.
Yeah, I do agree that it seems like the clothing concern was sort of just meandering out of nowhere for this particular story. Like, I find it funny at the beginning, like the opening line is like, nothing has topped his quest for the golden coat, you know, which is like,
right.
Well, if it was his big quest, then wouldn't we have heard about it? And, you know, earlier on, I find it funny. He just picks up like the bar of gold and says, yeah, I can make this into a coat.
Right.
Like, if you have any idea how that's going to work out.
I like too how Barks kind of spotlights for the reader how strange this is going to be. He says right off the bat in the little narrator box, what a strange adventure.
Strange adventures, yeah. So next we find Scrooge over at the tailor's trying to get his solid gold coat. And obviously it wouldn't work out because as the tailor tells him, the coat's going to be crinkly like tinfoil, which of course Scrooge doesn't thought about. You know, we see in these stories that Scrooge's sort of yearn for money kind of overcomes him when it comes to like logical, rational thinking, which I always find interesting. Right. Of course, the tailor name drops the golden fleece, which gets him interested. And we see kind of a shady character sitting in the background in like a silhouette, which is very interesting, colored in purple. Scrooge is walking away sad when he sees a big shadow following him. We get a nice chase sequence with a couple interesting poses. And here's where Scrooge rounds the corner as he's running away. And he finds Donald just hanging out on the corner, which is nice because this little small town dynamic, this mindset that Barks has that just walking around, you can run into someone you know, I find interesting, of course, just kind of tips his little hand. And of course, Barks didn't grow up in a big city where something like that would never happen.
Right. Yeah. It's interesting how he introduces this quote sinister, you know, foreign. I think he thinks, oh, that evil looking foreigner who is in the tailor shop. I don't think I even noticed him the first time, and I had to go back and look at it. It's a pretty stereotyped version of like a generic Middle Easterner.
Sure.
And I think it's kind of playing on the dynamic of the very paranoid, you know, mid-1950s.
Definitely.
So basically, you know, Scrooge is concerned that he's being pursued for this bar of gold. And I really like this chase sequence here, Austin, where Donald leads him through down into this coal chute, through an abandoned factory, through a bunch of culvert pipes, under a fence, and then hiding into a barrel. And the shtick is that it's where he hides when Daisy comes after him to mow her lawn. And first off, it's way more trouble probably than just mowing the dang lawn. But as a kid, I liked this little, you know, path, this little escape route that he had. And we get this very like unsettling image at the end of the sequence where this foreigner is literally sniffing around to try to find Scrooge. It's very weird.
Yeah, it's very so weird that it's very. Doesn't Scrooge do that as well? Doesn't he have a nose for money as well?
That's true. Yeah, this is it is like Scrooge. Every once in a while, he sniffs out gold, and that's what this weird foreigner is gonna do as well. But you know, he looks so sinister. Quote he. He looks so sinister, and his nose is so pronounced that it just looks. It looks unsettling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which I find very interesting. These sort of stereotypes. There's a lot of stuff in this story that wouldn't fly, as we'll see later on as well.
Oh, yes. There's a huge number of stereotypes in this one.
Anyway, on the next page, the man, the mysterious figure, has found Scrooge under the barrel and tells him he has a keen sense of smell, strong aroma of money. Which is very interesting because, of course, Donald has the bar now and Scrooge has nothing on him. So, you know, the jig's sort of up and Scrooge is wondering what's going on. And out of nowhere, this man pulls out a little bit of the famed golden fleece, which, of course, gets Scrooge right away. You know, he sort of falls for it. Like I was saying earlier, it's interesting that he just falls for it right away. You know, he doesn't really think too deeply, you know, what's going on here. You know, his kind of yearn for money takes away any sort of logical way of thinking, which I always found interesting.
Right. Yeah. It's Scrooge is very credulous in a lot of this story. I guess he's primed to be fleeced, as it were. And yeah, the weird foreigner starts name dropping all these things from the myth, right? He says that he doesn't specifically say immediately that it's from the Golden Fleece, but he says that it came from fabled Colchis, and it's from the land of the sleepless dragon. And then it kind of dawns on Scrooge all of a sudden, and he says that could be real wool from the Golden Fleece. And basically, this mysterious guy is saying how fortunate it is that we've met. And he's preparing to basically make a bargain with him for more of the Golden Fleece. And, you know, they kind of coordinate the details of this deal while Donald is eavesdropping. And at the end of this page, Austin, we get the first of this weirdo's tell, right, where he slips up. He says, it would mean a voyage to Colchis, Mr. McDuck. But, and then he giggles, come aboard the Argo and we'll talk it over with my brothers. So, you know, Barks is going to almost go overboard with this, where the man keeps like, when we meet those siblings, they're going to repeatedly almost refer to each other as sisters, and they're going to be giggling all over the place. So Barks is going to practically like signpost it that these weirdos are actually women. And then the nephews, Huey, Dewey, and Louie, happen upon Donald as he's spying on them. And he basically is going to fill them in.
Yeah, Donald comes around to the nephews and he says, I've been watching Uncle Scrooge and a stranger, a guy who's trying to sell him the Golden Fleece, which of course gets the woodchucks like super confused. You know, they go down to look at the ship. And of course they show up and it's like exactly as it appeared in the Book of Old Myths. Our Book of the Old Myths, as the nephews call it, which is interesting. Like, I always like the treasure hunt dynamic works very well, because the woodchucks with this book of like seemingly infinite knowledge are always able to clue in, as we're going to see, the reader on kind of what's going on. But of course, like, Barks can't expect every reader to know the Golden Fleece myth and everything behind it.
Right. He has to do like this very abridged kind of Cliff's Notes education, even if most people are going to know. It's going to be a lot of kids' first exposure.
Right, exactly. And Barks does it very well, you know, seemingly just inserts it in for a page or two, just the woodchucks reading out of their old guidebook and everything. So anyway, Donald and the nephews go over to the boat and they want to listen in, eavesdrop again. And Scrooge is on the boat. And of course, the man who's been following him says, Mr. McDuck, meet my sis. I mean my brothers. So he slips up again. And even I remember the first time I read this, of course I knew what was going on, but I still wasn't able to tell what was actually going to happen. I wonder if people who were reading this for the first time could be able to predict, like, these people that everyone is figuring are men are just going to pull off all their clothing and just be revealed to be these creepy bird women creatures, you know?
Right. Especially if you're reading it in, you know, for the first time with a cover that doesn't really give it away. You know, the album that I read, Don Rosa's, does show the Larkies on Don Rosa's cover, but like it doesn't connect them to these guys. So like I knew, just like you, I knew something was up, but I didn't know exactly what was. Do you want to read the full panel where he says their names as E-Crawl, whatever?
Sure. So yeah, he introduces his sis brothers as E-Crawl Senga, E-Crawl Zenny, E-Crawl Iseb, and E-Crawl Yoth. And he mentions his own name is E-Crawl Ali. And then another one of them mentions sons of the Queen of Seagrull. So that's how they kind of introduce themselves. And they're doing the classic big grin with the beard and sort of, you know, doing the little hand thing, rubbing the hands together.
Right. So there's a lot to take in here, Austin. So I guess, first off, the dynamic is we've got shifty, evil-looking foreigners. That's pretty unfortunate, but it's definitely kind of a relic of the time. I guess it is worth noting that they are in disguise, for what it's worth. Number two, the made-up name, it definitely sounds like it could be a country and it could be these, like, foreigner names. years, you know? So this construction that Barks has come up with, it's definitely stereotypical, but it's also very effective. And number three, this sequence is really, really creepy. Like if I step back and remember the first time that I read this, which would have been probably at age like 9 or 10, I remember like being very creeped out because they look giddily, dementedly like they're planning something horrible, you know? And these like interjections, Barks is really going overboard, signaling that they've got something nasty planned. So I think this is a good one to kind of step out of my own head and try to remember what it was like to read it the first time, because this is a creepy sequence. And basically the dynamic of the next page is that they, you know, Scrooge and them continue to, they talk business, as he says, and we see a little bit of conspiring between the sons of Seacrawl and planning to sail back to Colchis. So, you know, we know that they're on the up and up about Colchis, at least, because they're referencing it amongst themselves in whispered voices. But just as they're getting ready to, we figure, probably kidnap Scrooge, the nephews who have been eavesdropping on this business spot this really creepy looking shadow. And the nephew describes it as a big bird came out on deck and saw us and darted back, a bird with a funny head. I don't know about you, Austin, but I really think that out of context, that shadow is freaky.
That shadow is super freaky. And you mentioned people who had read the comic originally with like just the gag cover having zero clue about what was really going on. I had zero clue what was going on here. Right. So, you know, for someone who might have had the Rosa cover with the, you know, the Larkies and everything, you might have been able to clue yourself in. But like, there's not a lot of resemblance between these creepy brothers that are, you know, conning Scrooge right now in this bird shadow. So for the gag cover, it is very effective. You think back for Barks to like sort of keep readers still very much not in the know, if that makes sense.
Right.
You know.
Yeah, I think that's a great point.
So anyway, on the next page, the nephew's cluing Donald on what's going on. Of course, he says all birds have funny heads, which I
like that a lot.
That is funny. You know, Scrooge is sort of supposing something's wrong because he's not as eager to get back into it. Now the jig is really up with these guys because they're whispering behind his back and saying, we'll have to have our rich plaything come back later when his spying relatives aren't along to raise Cain. So they figure they'll send him away. They say their fee to take him to the Golden Fleece is 5 bars of gold. So Scrooge says, you know what, I'll think about it. And we go to a little bit later where he's walking along with his nephews. And they're like, you're not really going to sail with him, are you? But Scrooge is saying, well, you know, if I'll have to... I'm going to go get that fabulous fleece. So it's interesting because the nephews and Donald are usually up for the adventure, but here they're sort of suspecting more. Like Donald's usually not one to understand like the true danger of a situation, whereas Scrooge is. So it's kind of interesting to see like the opposites and the dynamic and like sort of considering what's really right and what's wrong. What should they do and not do?
Yeah, definitely. I think that's a good point. It's interesting too that like Scrooge is talking about how he's kind of eager for this adventure to be like Jason after the Golden Fleece. Right. And he's not usually motivated by the desire for adventure, you know, in these stories, in Barks stories, at least. DuckTales, the series, kind of like changes that so that he loves the quest. But in general, I don't think that's really what he's usually about.
Right.
And I'm perceiving that he's been just a little bit bewitched by his like actual view of that golden wall, right? Because in the next couple of pages, they're going to kind of egg him on by showing him that.
Right. Austin, and on to that, like what you were saying about him not being very eager for adventure, it is true that in most of the stories, the adventure isn't like something they choose to go on, right? It's usually a result of some mishap or screw up, and they have to go on it to retrieve, you know, this item or this amount of money. But here, they're sort of willingly throwing themselves into it, and it is interesting to see Scrooge like so eager.
Yeah, at least Scrooge is. The nephews, they're really their only interest is kind of holding him back. That's actually what kind of annoyed me about the second DuckTales series, is that they kind of retconned them into being like always down for an adventure. But like it was really about the treasure hunt for Scrooge. That's just my kind of side note. So, you know, basically the kids, they go back to kind of try and figure out more. You mentioned that they're the woodchucks, right? They're gonna consult their guidebook, and they're kind of remembering what they know about the ancient story. They give a real Cliff's Notes version that says Jason was sent to fetch the Golden Fleece from the palace of Ares in Colchis. And then they very quickly mention, after scattering some bird-like creatures and knocking out a sleepless dragon, right? So that's going to kind of set up the rest of the story, just that one little panel. And then he took the fleece back to Greece and married a witch named Medea. And boy, that part of the story, the later parts of it end up being really sad and gruesome. And so they try to find out more in the guidebook, and Donald tails Scrooge to his office. And when Scrooge unlocks his office, he is shocked to see Secral Ali already relaxing at his desk. And Secral Ali is being this really big weirdo, talking about how, you know, this is easy for someone. I came in through the window, a feat which is easy for someone from Colchis. And basically you sense, Austin, that Ali is there because he wants to reel in Scrooge. He wants to hold up that fleece and kind of enchant him by how weird he is, and just dangle that fleece under his nose. And it works. He gets Scrooge a little bit enchanted, and he gets him to follow him out of the office. And, you know, Donald prepares to tail after him. And you want to tell us about what happens next, or if you have any comments?
Sure, yeah. I just find it interesting that Donald cares this much about Scrooge. Usually he's so... Scrooge is so hard on Donald, you would think he's not going to be that quick to get all the help he needs from his, you know, nephew, but apparently he does. But anyway, a nice bit of foreshadowing. Donald gets hit by some flying object that knocks him over the head, and only leaves one black feather floating down. You know, so we've had the strange bird-like creature reference in this, and it's all very nicely foreshadowing what's to come. And here's that little... sort of Cliff's Note version of the whole Golden Fleece thing that I was mentioning earlier, the exposition that he needs sort of to set up the story. You know, Medea got sore at Jason and skipped back to Colchis, taking the Golden Fleece with her, they say. So they sort of run through it. She hung it in the Hall of Echoes. Then the bird-like creatures came to live in Colchis, and the sleepless dragon resumed his vigil. So, you know, they kind of run through it real fast just to give you that basic understanding. And while they're doing all of that, Secral Ali is already on the boat with Scrooge, and they're already getting ready to sail with Donald close on their trail.
Right. Can you tell from the text, Austin, where they must have had Barks reletter it? Bird-like creatures sounds pretty awkward, or funny birds or whatever. I think they must have been reading about harpies originally.
They must have, because I know a lot of it had to be edited for the publication. So
right, and the nephews do get that realization, or the one who saw the shadow says, "Ye cats, that's what I saw aboard the Argo." But the others, you know, are skeptical still.
Sure.
And again, all of this is deeply unsettling. This whole time, right? We've got, I think this is really exciting too, and it would be cool to have this put to screen where you see the nephews kind of frantically learning as much as they can while Donald is desperately running to the boat. You want to keep telling us about Donald boarding the boat?
Yeah, so of course they find him out. The brothers, Secrals, find him out. They sort of pull him on board by cane to the neck, which looks super painful. They call him Mr. Quacky Face. So now the humiliation is really through the roof. Anyway, Donald gets pulled into the room with Scrooge, and he's just going over his 5 bars of gold fee. But Donald is saying, you know, there's something fishy about this ship, and he's trying to pull him off. But as Scrooge, you know, just, of course, doesn't listen to Donald, because why would you? He's pulling out his 5 bars of gold, and the brothers take the gold and throw it right out.
Do you mind, Austin, reading Scrooge's word balloon there and their response? Because it's really well set up.
Oh, sure. Which, the one in the bottom
left? I've paid for. Scrooge says, I've paid.
Yeah, Scrooge says, I've paid for my voyage with 5 bars of gold. I'm sure these men respect their obligation. So the brothers grab the gold. They say, oh, sure, we respect it. Like this. And they throw all the gold right out the window, you know, which of course leaves Scrooge like absolutely stupefied. You threw your gold overboard. Why? The brothers say, because we have no use for gold in Colchis. And this is really trippy. We have no use for these garments either. And we get a super creepy panel. Brothers start taking off all their clothing. One of them even throws away a mask. This is what I find really weird. A mask of their face with the big nose and the beard and the mustache. And they all start undressing and they reveal themselves as those creepy bird-like creatures, the Larkies. And this is a really weird panel. They are... like, they look kind of the same in the face, but they have this short black hair and like a ponytail, earrings, red and yellow earrings, and like big bird feet and wings. And of course, you have the classic like hat jumping off the head for Donald and Scrooge in the corner, who are absolutely terrified.
Right. This has got to be one of Bark's best like reveals ever, right? It really bears repeating how unsettling this is. And it's kicked off with that great moment where they just callously throw Scrooge's bars of gold out the window. We as the reader know something has gone horribly wrong when we see that. It's such a great shocking moment to us and Scrooge. And then when they like disrobe that way and then we see them, they're really meant to look like a caricature of an unattractive woman too. You know, I think Barks is generally, it's not a kind representation of kind of femininity throughout the rest of the story here.
Right.
Because these, I would say that they're really meant to depict kind of a like unpleasant, shrewish woman who's focused on cooking and gossip and competition. And I mean, you know, they're harpies, but the point is that they're just really, they're women first. That's why they've been like giggling where we are supposed to see them as women.
Right. And it's funny you mentioned shrewish woman, because when I was looking into the harpy larky sort of debacle, the actual definition for a harpy under Merriam-Webster is shrewish woman.
Right.
Interesting.
Right. Yeah. I wonder if it was like crossed wires, because I've never heard of it as a reference for a streetwalker or a prostitute, but I've heard it as like really unpleasant woman. I'm pretty sure even in other Bark stories that someone like uses the word harpy for a woman.
That'd be very interesting.
So that page continues with the kids still, you know, the reader knows what's going on, but here's where the kids figure it out. They read that travelers near the region of ancient Colchis believe that the strange birds, sometimes called larkies, still live there. So I think that's our first time that we've actually seen the word larky in this, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they go on to read that wild giggling has been heard on moonless nights in the Valley of the Mists, and natives have found huge bird tracks in their sheepfolds. And then another nephew has kind of sussed out the little backwards writing, basically the reversing trick. This is a fun trope, right? I can't remember if I had seen it coming or not. I knew there was something weird about those names. But he says, I wrote those guys' names backward on this piece of paper, and it spells Larky. So Seacrawl, we've just learned the word Larky. So maybe we haven't figured it out. I think if Barks had gotten to use Harpy like he wanted to, which would also look kind of like suitably foreign, we might have recognized it more easily. And they go through it and they say Ikral Senga is Larky Agnes, and Ikral Zenny is Larky Inez, and Ali is Ela, and so on. The nerve of them.
Right. Yeah. You mentioned the sort of, if you could tell whether or not that reverse name thing was coming. I certainly couldn't. I mean, I know it was one of my first Bark stories, but like the reveal of the Larkies and the name, like everything really floored me when I first read this one.
It's a really well-constructed reveal. Whether you see it coming or not, I think it's got a great impact in this story.
Yeah.
He fosters such a unsettling atmosphere all like in this first half. It's weird, Austin. The second half, when you actually get there, is like less unsettling than all the buildup.
Right. I actually was going to bring this up. It's in my notes, but it's like I was so disappointed upon rereading, because in my mind, what lasted in my memory was that first half with this great reveal and this splash panel on 14 of the Larkies, like flying away with the boat, which is really weird. But then we sort of spiral into the second half and it's like, wait a minute, this is almost like a different story, you know?
Yeah, it's this weird, we're gonna enter into this weird domestic dispute thing.
Yeah, like almost like it would have worked with Daisy and like her friends back at home, you know? Like you don't
need to
work with it at all.
Yeah, parts of this definitely feel like a Daisy story. Tell us about that splash panel though, because it is great.
Yeah, this is a very cool panel. The nephews run off, of course. They realize everything. They go down to the dock, but they see the Larkies in the distance. This is really cool. Above, like, the moon or the sun, and they're flying away with the boat attached to, like, their wings. And it's all in silhouette, so it's very creepy. Of course, one of the nephews finds a note on the side from Donald. We're prisoners of Larkies. Save us. You know, and they're thinking about how to save them. And one of the nephews just, well, it costs thousands of dollars to travel that far. Another one says, and we're broke. The only way we can get there is to swim. So, of course, one of them just dives in and starts swimming. Hey, you wild-eyed hero, I didn't mean that we could swim. The guy who's in the water says, I wasn't swimming the ocean. I was diving in to see what was shining on the bottom. And it's just what I thought it was. Gold, 5 bars of it, just waiting to be fished out of the drink. So, of course, this is cleverly structured by Barks. Those bars that were thrown out a couple pages later now are coming
into play. That's an extremely tightly constructed and funny, engaging sequence.
Yeah.
I really like it. So I noted, Austin, that when the nephews see what's happened with the Larkies departing, one of them says, brother, this is one time we really missed the boat. And you know, that's an idiom. That's an expression in English. And it occurs to me, like literally right now, that I wonder if Barks decided to do that because there's going to be another idiom that's going to be very important at the end of this story, the pulling the wool over the eyes.
Yeah. Oh, that might be interesting. You might be right on that.
Oh, sure. You know what, Austin? It's weird that I think we're 15 pages or so into this story. We've had most of the first half and it's been entirely confined to Duckburg in this setup. He really lets the beginning of the story breathe.
Yeah. Sort of takes his time with it.
Yeah. So, we see the nephews making their preparations to travel to Colchis overseas, and they transfer to a helicopter in Asia Minor. So we're in like the Turkey, you know, the Europe and Turkey kind of border. And they reference having some special weapons for battling the Larkies along with their junior woodchucks. And Barks kind of takes care of getting any other support. He He hand waves it by saying, "No policeman will ever believe our story." And now they head to the Valley of the Mists, where the pilot says that, you know, they will be the first persons in centuries to enter that creepy place. Not our first time being in a Valley of Mists in a Barks story, huh?
Oh, yeah. Right. Interesting.
Yeah, Barks really enjoys like fog as an element of mystery, and it works great. You know, we've seen it in Plane Awful, Golden Helmet itself, right? Had a great fog scene. So here we are in an entire valley of it, and they have the pilot drop them off near, prepare to get dropped off near some old ruins that they see. And if give us any comments or tell us about Larky headquarters.
Yeah, we'll jump right into the next page, because this is really where it gets sort of peculiar, but yes. Very, very cool art-wise, because I really like the fog sort of background effect we get in a couple select panels here.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, we cut to Donald and Scrooge as prisoners of the Larkies. They're up in like some very cool tree stump like nest that's like way up in the sky. And of course, the Larkies are flying around and like the classic shaking hands and laughing, and they're all happy because their successful trip to your country to find a rich taster, they found the first sucker that fell for our golden fleece story. Taster, like, what are they talking about, you know?
Right.
So they're all laughing and they're very excited, and Donald says, "I noticed that they called you a taster. I hope they didn't mean that to refer to your flavor." Scrooge says, "I noticed that they called me a sucker. I know what they mean by that."
I'm glad you highlighted it. That's a good line.
Yeah. Of course, Scrooge is angry because there's no golden fleece, or at least he thinks, until the Larky tells him, "Oh, yes, there is. It's hanging right over there in the ruins of that palace, but you couldn't get to it, even if we let you go." And of course, it's revealed that there's a big dragon, and he hisses and scares the crap out of Scrooge and Donald up in the nest, and they're left furious.
Right. Hey, so Austin, it just occurred to me, you're reading Uncle Scrooge number 12. So you've got the kind of redrawn panels, don't you? Because this is the sequence where the Larkies, he had to like modify the Larkies, because they looked a little bit too lunatic, right?
Holy cow. I've never seen that before.
Yeah. So the Gladstone for the album, I think that was the first time that they had the restored art. But it's worth seeing. They do look insane. I don't think there was any reason to censor it. But they look... No. They look daffy. They're just like laughing at what a sucker Scrooge has been. But it's really great artwork. And I love how they're really just delighted at what a sucker they've made of him.
Yeah.
And so on the next page, you know, we've got Donald, we've got Scrooge really stewing in having been suckered and angry at his predicament. And he threatens them. He says, "I want to go home. Let me out of here before I forget that you're ladies." And we get a very weird scene where one of the Larkies puts him over her knee and spanks him like he's a naughty little boy. So like, we're kind of figuring out that, you know, they're here at their pleasure. They really are prisoners, but they're always being depicted as unpleasant ladies. You know, there's never any other hint of menace other than that.
I do find it very interesting. It's playing off like all the stereotypes, like women who like spank their kids, and courses we're going to see like women who are awful cooks and women like all these things that are just so crazy. Like, it's just so shocking to read in like sort of modern society, you know, when like all the standards have changed and stuff.
Right. It's kind of evocative of the old like Catskills comedian, you know, "Take my wife, please." So, you know, the Larkies tell him to sit tight until we have something ready for you to taste. And when Scrooge asks about that, you know, they say, "That's a secret." And we get more of that maddening cackling, giggling that they're constantly doing.
Right. And at this point, like, the suspense and the thrill of that first half is still very much so still there, because the tasting could be anything. Like, Barks has already right. sort of tripped up the standards and the expectations by having this whole gang of villains being turning from men to women. So, like, you're not really sure what to expect anymore.
Yeah, we're totally off balance.
Yeah, it gets very disappointing with this whole taste reveal. Is just exactly what it sounds like, really.
I agree. It's a little bit, I love this story, but it is a little bit of a letdown.
Yeah, because it could be so many other things, right? Anyway, Donald and Scrooge are up there in the nest, and they're thinking back to the old myth about how the Larkies kept prisoners for years, and every time they would sit down to eat, they would put awful tasting things on the prisoner's plate. Parsnip pudding is what Scrooge recalls one of the things being, which throws him into a tizzy because he apparently hates parsnips, which is a bizarre thing to hate, I suppose. Do you have any idea, Mark, if that's like part of an original myth? Like, did they actually put things?
So I didn't look this up specifically, but I'm like 99% confident that there's no mention of parsnips in you know, he's not totally off base here, right? Because the specific part of the myth is that they had King, oh man, what was the king's name? I can't remember. King whatever. They depicted this in the Ray Harryhausen movie too, where this king would have, in fact, they would have banquets of wonderful looking food set out for him, but every time he tried to eat it, the Larkies would come and like remove it and destroy it, and he would have to like subsist off the little crumbs and remnants of the food. So they don't actually feed him gross stuff. They prevent him from eating delightful stuff is how the actual myth goes. So Barks has massaged it a little bit for his own end. I do like the this goofy Scrooge trait, right, where he hates parsnips.
Yeah,
I don't like the rest of the like cooking competition aspect of it, but I do think it's funny that Scrooge has this one specific root vegetable that he hates.
Right, just like this obscure food that just shows up for no reason is like this big problem. Anyway, Scrooge and Donald, while they're fretting over that, the nephews have just landed, and their helicopter just sort of shoots out of the scene off to the side, and the nephews are kind of just investigating the ruins, and we get a cool panel with a couple bats and banshees, as the nephews put it, flying around, and they hear a couple noises over from the echoes, and they hear, you know, that dragon that Scrooge and Donald were hearing earlier, which of course terrifies the nephews as well.
Yeah, I like the image a lot of their like duck feathers, their hair standing on end, and their fear of the dragon, and how one of them says, golly, we never figured on him being still around Colchis. Again, you know, Barks is still amping up the kind of like unsettling, creepy nature. It's nice that this is going to be a kind of a Halloween proximate episode, because I think this is pretty appropriate for it.
Oh, yeah. Nice. Yeah, that'll be fitting.
So the nephews eventually, you know, they hide because they don't want to be seen in all that noise. And they get to see one of the Larkies, and they kind of marvel at it. One of them calls an overgrown canary. But unfortunately, they lose sight of it before they can follow it back to Scrooge and Donald. And I guess here's where we get the kind of disappointing revelation, Austin. Barks transitions us to a kitchen in a clear part of the valley where the Larkies are cooking food and discussing how they could find a rich old duck to be their food taster, talking about how he must be used to only the fanciest of victuals. And we learn pretty quickly that they've had this lifelong argument over who is the best cook. And we get a little comedic reference to their recipes being disgusting. The first of several, where one of them says, quit bumping my stirring arm. You've caused my toadstool marmalade to stick to the skillet. I do like the goofy recipes, Austin, even if I don't like the overall premise of it.
Sure. Of course, there are a couple things to like about it, but this is where it starts to take that really weird turn into these horrifying creatures who capture people alive and take them back to their ancient ruins are now like cooking and like chatting it up, you know, which gets just kind of peculiar. So anyway, on the next page, we find them talking, and apparently whoever has the best meal, whoever Scrooge decides is the best cook of the five there are, gets to become the queen of the Larkies, which of course excites them all. Actually, one of them starts to get thinking and says, I'm going to win that honor, even if I have to cheat a little bit to do it. So they run off. She runs off, Sister Agnes is this one, and goes over to Scrooge and gives him a bit of a business deal, as she puts it. She says, it's agreed then that if you select my recipe as the best, I will allow you to escape from Colchis. Scrooge agrees to it, and she says, and besides, if you will eat all of my discs just to floor my sisters, I will grant you another favor. I'll tell you how you can bypass the sleepless dragon and make off with the golden fleece, which of course gets Scrooge and Donald very excited, and Sister Agnes flies off. And even at this point in the story, like, I could tell what the dish was going to be made of and where it's going to go from here.
Right. I mean, it's only been a couple of pages since he name dropped Hating Parsnip. I wonder if it might have been better if he had introduced the parsnip somehow in the first part of the story, but that might have been tricky to kind of shoehorn in. So pretty quickly here, Austin, we come to the food tasting ceremony portion of the story. Okay, so I've already made clear that I don't really like this overall premise that much, but I will admit I do like how it actually plays out, right? Like it's very funny how we get this sequence of the Larkies introducing their horrible dishes. Donald and Scrooge have some really great gruesome expressions at the terrible smells emanating from the Larkies' kitchen. And so Larky Faye sets her dish in front of him and lovingly introduces it as curried rhubarb pulp with curdled milkweed sauce. And Scrooge's face and his thought balloon saying shudder. That's an awesome panel. That might be a pick of mine. I wonder, Austin, have you ever gone back and, you know, seen how the internet will highlight some of the terrible old recipes from this era?
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if this is like just making fun of some of the random experimentation that housewives were encouraged to do around this time.
That actually sounds like the best fit for it, because otherwise it just seems weird that they're right. Just like coming up with these awful things, you know?
Because there was a lot of weird post-war cooking experimentation going on. Mm-hmm. And while Scrooge is choking this down, you know, one of them, I like that he's brisk about this. He doesn't have each one serve them. He just has two of the other Larkies talking about their dishes, one of which is sulfured sauerbraten with vinegar gravy. And then Bessie's is, no, he'll love my birdseed biscuits more. And Inez does get to serve her famous tossed tumbleweed salad with cod liver oil dressing. And we do finally get to Agnes, who remembers their little deal, and Scrooge acknowledges he is to eat all of this dish and asks, what is it? And predictably, she announces that it's parsnip pudding, and he pratfalls right over. It's super predictable, but it's very funny. I do like it. So which of those dishes sounds the least horrible to you, Austin?
I don't know. It might be that tumbleweed sound. No, it might be the birdseed biscuits. They don't sound that terrible.
Yeah, I think it's probably got to be one of those. I mean, I guess the parsnip pudding on its own doesn't sound so bad. So
just, I don't want to be eating any of those anytime soon.
Yeah. All right. So, a bargain is a bargain, as Barks notes in his narrator box. That's a great narrator box. And Scrooge does his best. He's very game. He pantomimes loving it as he eats it. And Donald gets this great sardonic line: if this acting were for the Academy Awards, you'd win every Oscar in the place. It's awesome. And so, you know, we transition quickly. Barks doesn't bother with any ceremony here. He doesn't really care about the Larkies at this point. The Queen Agnes tells them that it's their chance to sneak away while the other girls are sulking. And she tells them that the directions, she tells them where the tunnel that'll take them beneath the dragon station to the open end of the Hall of Echoes. And she tells him that it's at the inner end where the, quote, boomerang stone reverses the echoes. So they run off, and this leaves Agnes kind of pondering her now predicament as she reflects on the fact that, you know, her sisters are going to be really mad when they learn that she's let the prisoners escape. So she decides to do, I guess this is the fleece. I guess this is kind of one of the double cross aspects of it. I mean, the whole thing, the tricking them here is part of it, but there's a lot of crossing and double crossing. She adds one more secret to Scrooge about the Hall of Echoes. And she thinks that this trick is going to make her a heroine to her sisters. So she says, because it's a dark and winding tunnel, you need to find your way to the fleece by shouting and listening for the return of the echo, and that the special word is sea crawl. And of course, Donald and Scrooge didn't figure out what the nephews did.
Right.
So
I don't know. I found the whole thing very contrived, with Agnes coming up with this plan and going through with it all this far, and then Barks just having her like, oh, maybe I shouldn't, and then bringing it in and having her sort of take it back and then having her turn on him, you know. So it all seems like very contrived almost.
I agree with you. I had pretty much the exact same impression. This part of the story, can we maybe agree right now that the first half of this story is dramatically stronger than the resolution? I do like the whole story on its, even despite my criticisms here, you know. But like, I think the first part of it's just so strong.
Yeah. First part is definitely stronger. And I do think it drops off, especially with the whole unnecessary like dragon sequence that we're going to come up to. Yeah. Definitely didn't have to be a full 32 pager, but it is still a pretty good story.
Right.
Anyway, without thinking about it any further, Donald and Scrooge go into the halls and they think, okay, well, I'll sneak roll into this hallway to see what's going on. And we get a nice little panel in the bottom of these old ruins, right? It feels like very Seven Cities of Gold or like Indiana Jones almost, which I think is cool. Nice little twist. Yeah. So they get to the hallway and they yell, sneak roll. They wait for the echo. They put their hand in their ear, classic. And it comes back, of course, screaming, Larkies, which gets the actual Larkies, you know, all in a tizzy. Get up. It's old McDuck trying to get the golden fleece to the palace, girls. I don't know how they were able to find out it was him and him trying to get the fleece right away. But anyway, Agnes is all excited. So they go out in search of him. And Donald, this is what I really like this. Donald and Scrooge are trying to get out. And the Larkies just show up with all this food, all these like old fruits, and just start whipping them at them. Just knock them to the floor, which I just found like totally weird.
Yeah, it is pretty weird. So this previous page had one of my pet peeves, Austin. The trope where like someone says something backwards. So like if you say sea crawl backwards, it's not gonna work like that, right? Like you can't just say a word how it's spelled. It doesn't, you know, if you actually reverse audio. So you have to think about phonetically how it gets reversed. So let's see, like if you said sea crawl first, it starts with an S sound and Larkies ends with a Z sound. You know what I mean? So like at best it would be like Larkies. So anyway, it always annoys me when people think think that it works like that. I do like it is very quick and contrived too, how the queen of the Larkies just quickly tosses off, I'm the one that tricked him into this so we could have some fun.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, go ahead.
Anyway, Donald and Scrooge are being bombed by this, you know, food. And of course, the nephews are to the rescue, as they always are. They're running out. They have all these sort of supplies and weapons with them. And they're up on the roof of the hallways, and they're looking over. And one nephew goes, "Well, would you look at that?" And the other one says, "Larkies flying formations like dive bombers." And it's just kind of a peculiar image of, like, the Larkies, like, soaring down, like, they're B-19s into, like, the, you know,
right.
So they have all these weapons with them, rockets with pinwheel warheads, and they light them off and sort of set them out to scare the Larkies, but not to hurt them, because, as they're going to mention in a little bit, you can't hit a woman.
Yeah, we're continuing that old trope, right? Like, these are not monsters. They are women first, basically, to Barks and his characters.
Right.
I do like that we get one more mention of parsnips, Austin, as that's one of the foods that they get dive bombed with.
Oh, nice. I actually missed that originally. Anyway, we get a bit of a neat little fighting sequence between the nephews and the Larkies, and they're throwing up the rockets that keep lighting them, but the Larkies pick up handfuls of rocks, I guess.
Yeah, they escalate.
Are they throwing them down at the nephews, or are they just, like, threatening them with?
Well, I think they're getting ready to when the nephews decide they have to, you know, release their secret weapon.
Oh, I guess so. That just seems kind of weird pacing. But, you know, anyway, you can't get angry at this part of the story for being weird.
Right. We've had a lot of weird before this.
Yeah. And to top it all with weird, because I think this is super, super weird and super funny, is, of course, they can't shoot rockets at ladies, so they have to pull out their super secret weapon, which is tiny little mice on balloons. And of course, because women are so horrified of mice, the Larkies fly away, never to be seen again.
Right.
He's laughing.
Yeah, they give a rejoinder. He, he, he. It's silly. This is not, I imagine there are a lot of readers who really like this and are still amused. A lot of old time Barks fans are probably still amused by this kind. This doesn't really work for me that well these days, but yeah. I understand people like this kind of thing.
Yeah, I get it. Of course, like 1950s, it was sort of a narrative trope. Of course, we've all seen, like, that image in the cartoons of, like, the woman jumping on the table at the mouse and, like, picking up the skirt and everything. But
absolutely,
like you were saying, this is one of those parts of the story that would probably not fly very well today.
It's a trope, and sometimes tropes are just funny because they're funny, I guess.
Sure. Yeah, exactly.
So, you know, we get this sequence where the nephews finally reveal that they've come along to save Donald and Scrooge. And we get a really quick transition. There's no real reunion here. I like that they hold up their little woodchucks sign, you know, and say it's Troop One of the Duckburg Patrol of the Junior Woodchucks of the World. And, you know, we get this moment where Scrooge wants to keep going and find the fleece by following the echoes, but the nephews say phooey on that. They plan to use floodlights and a compass. And at this point, Barks needs to wrap the story up, or he needs to kind of get it going. So there's no more real travails. They find the fleece. It's like hanging off this cool looking wall. Scrooge gives a great money hungry lunge towards it. This is an image that he captured in one of the oils that looks pretty great.
Yeah. And also that Rosa captured in his Gladstone cover, of course.
Right. Yeah. That's the second cover, I guess, that Rosa did for this one. Right. Cause,
yeah, right. He did the one with the Larkies and then the one with, like, you know, the,
yeah, one for Uncle Scrooge Adventures. I think this one is really indicative of Rosa at the earlier part of his career. I think that one's a lot stronger.
Yeah, for sure.
The dragon in this one is shown in full, and he looks almost plastic. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Scrooge is like really ecstatic and he's kissing the golden wool, but the ducks remind him, we've got to worry about getting out of here. Let's turn around from this dead end. And Scrooge is super excited to you know, see it in the light, in the daylight. And why don't you take it from here?
Sure, of course. Sarah, very excited, but I guess not everything has come to a resolution yet, because here we come to the most peculiar add-on to the story, I suppose. This part that didn't have to be here and probably could have been like a separate story entirely on its own, where, of course, Scrooge is excited and he's got the fleece and we're running out with it. And the nephews and Donald are on his trail and they hear an eek and a chomp. And turns out there's just that big dragon, which is hanging around the corner, that just engulfed Scrooge alive, I suppose.
Right.
And like here we've got that cool sort of thing where the dragon was lingering through the whole story. They mentioned him at the beginning and, you know, Donald and Scrooge heard him and the nephews heard him when, of course, they showed up. And it didn't really play into anything. So now it's coming into play when it's like very much so out of the reader's like short-term memory. So it is a cool reveal. And this is right. A nice panel, but it's largely unnecessary as we're going to see.
Yeah, you're right, probably on all counts. You know, even the ducks have forgotten about him. Donald like actually kind of foregrounds that by saying we clean forgot about him. And we're immediately reassured that Scrooge is alive because he is yelling for help from the mouth of the dragon, right, who's licking his lips. Boy, Austin, this dragon looks like such a big dope.
He looks like the Disney dragon from The Reluctant Dragon in the face. He looks like zero of a threat.
Maybe like the Reluctant Dragon or a little bit Pete's dragon. I kind of love him. He is so over the top weird. He has horns and he has like little bells that dangle from them and this long spindly tail and these weird offset legs, and just this glazed look in his eyes because he is the sleepless dragon.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we've got a great woodchucks figuring things out scene here. You know, they've got to frantically look through their guidebook for some advice on how to make a dragon open his jaws. And this is one of Bark's great things, his great tropes, where they're like debating over what chapter they should be in. Could it be on the chapter on dental work? No, it'd be under lockjaw. No, don't get so rattled. It'd be in the section on unusual beasts. And they eventually get the advice to dump 4 to 10 pounds of pepper into the dragon's nose, depending on the size of the dragon, to make him open his mouth to sneeze. Being out of pepper, they find the next closest thing, a bottle of mustard that they use for pneumonia plasters. Austin, that seems like a treatment that's been lost to a couple of generations back, I guess. I admit I didn't look up what the heck that is.
Yeah, neither did I. I have zero idea what's going on.
That's fine. But this ground mustard does the trick. They wing it right into his nostril and he lets loose a big sneeze, and we get this funny little gag where a nephew asks, was that Uncle Scrooge that was blown by? And Donald says, yes, I heard him say Gesundheit as he passed.
It was just funny, nice little gag, I suppose.
Yeah.
Anyway, they find Scrooge in the corner as he was shot out of the dragon's nostril, and they try to make a break for it with the fleece as the dragon is building up for another sneeze. So they duck into this little like hole in the wall, I assume they found, because they try to make it to the tunnel before he sneezes. They realize it's too late, so they duck into the hole, and as the dragon lets out the sneeze, I think it's his toes that cover up the hole. They slam against the little hole that they came through.
Right.
And, you know, one of those funny panels of just a bunch of eyes in like the black darkness. One mm-hmm. of the ducks says, he's got us trapped in a one door cubby hole. Another one says, it'll keep us here forever. He's that mad. And I guess they turn on a light or something in the next panel, because then you can see everybody. And so the pool, of course, they pull out the guidebook to see what's going on, how to solve the problem, as they always do. And the nephew finds that the guidebook says to pull the wool over his eyes. And I think Scrooge speaks for me too, where he says kind of vague directions, you know?
Right. Yeah. So this is what I had referenced, that this is like a common saying for tricking someone, right? You pull the wool over someone's eyes. And it is vague, but the nephews know immediately what it means to do. And they grab the fleece from a reluctant Scrooge, promising to bring it back. I like this scene a lot, but it is admittedly a little contrived, right? Because the dragon is covering the hole. They've got to, one of the nephews has got to tickle him to distract while the other sneaks out. I'm like, okay, well, maybe if you can sneak out, you can figure out something. But anyway, this ends up being the best way. He scales his weird backbone, puts the golden fleece over the dragon's eyes. And the dragon, I guess, we're meant to think he's so focused on watching the captive ducks that he somehow doesn't notice. And the narrator box tells us that for the first time in eons, the sleepless dragon can't see, because it seems like, I guess we're meant to see that he doesn't really have eyelids. The coloring that I've got here has his eyes very reddish. I don't know if the original coloring showed it that way.
Yeah, his eyes in the original are just like the classic black pupil and then like the white outside. Sure. Yeah,
so that's kind of a nice touch that the Gladstone colorer, I bet it was Susan Daigle Leach, no, it's Mike McCormick, apparently. That was a cool choice, right? Because like that seems like something that would go along with him being the sleepless dragon. But anyway, we can guess what happens here. He finally dozes off. He gets a really satisfying looking sleep. And the ducks, we get one panel where the ducks say farewell to the Larkies and their ghastly cookbook, as Scrooge says.
Yeah. I wasn't very sure what happened to that fleece they put over his eyes. Did they just keep it there and they had enough left over?
I mean, my read is that like he needed that nap so much that even when they took it away, he probably stayed asleep. But I guess there's a reason that Barks doesn't show it to us, because maybe you can't. It was too hard to show the mechanics of it, so he just glossed over it.
Something like that, yeah.
So why don't you take us home?
So, of course, Scrooge is all happy. Goodbye to that old broadcloth coat that I bought in Scotland in 1902. As soon as I have my new gold coat made from this fleece, I'll throw this old threadbare rag in the trash can. So we fast forward a little bit to 1 month later. They're back home in Duckburg, as the narrator box puts it. And the nephews are all excited because the golden coat is coming back from the tailor today. And they go over to the office, I guess the McDuck building, and Scrooge isn't in there. So they kind of round the corner. He's here in the alley, and they see him putting his old coat in the trash can until they talk to him and they realize he's not putting it in. He's taking it out, because as Scrooge puts it, this doggone glittering golden Macintosh is the coldest contraption I ever had on my back. Of course, nephews just kind of laugh at that as we close out the story. So I guess the whole journey was for naught then.
Right. I love the ending. I think as far as like gag endings to adventure stories go, that's one of Bark's best. Like it's such a great little bit of poetic, you know, we've gone to all this effort and that thing, it's like, be careful what you wish for, right? That thing that he wanted the whole time was not going to do it for him. So, I think it's a great ending. I love the image of him looking upset in his shiny, glittering new coat. What about you?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't think about it like that when I first read it, but I do like sort of the careful what you wish for that you mentioned. I didn't think about it like that. And of course, like if you think about it in like sort of an adventure comedy story, there's not much better for an ending you can do than just like a funny gag, I suppose. So even if it's not like fully satisfactory, it is kind of all he could work with here. So,
yeah. Right. We had to see the coat. right? We had all this buildup. We have to see the outcome. We had him go to the trouble, or that nice tailor went to the trouble of explaining why a real gold coat wouldn't work. So yeah, that ending I find very satisfying. How about the overall story, Austin? And I know that you and I have talked kind of through what we think about it, but any other thoughts, anything you want to add to it?
Yeah, I know we were both pretty critical of that weird second half there, but it is still very good. It's still one of the greatest. And that first half is really good, like one of the all-time greats. So yeah, very entertaining, some great art, couple great gags. So yeah, definitely a great Scrooge story.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. You know, the lead up to what happens, the way the adventure sets off is like this real masterpiece of creepy, atmospheric, unsettling setup. And it takes this turn once they actually get there that I'm not wholly satisfied with. But on the whole, I still really like this one. I love how he kind of integrates all this stuff from the quote actual myth in a way that really works within the Ducks universe, I think. I like Scrooge's motivation here. I like the idea of, you know, the richest man in the world looking for something that is both a trophy and just a way to wear some clothes that really fit him. I like all the sort of Junior Woodchucks elements of this. You mentioned that it's kind of maybe packed full of one monster too many. And like, I agree with you, the dragon is a little bit tacked on, but he's so goofy and he's so funny. And it kind of struck me that it's like the Greek myths, you know, when they go through, it's like monster after monster it's like monster after monster in so many of those stories. So it is maybe one element too many, and some of the larky stuff might be a little bit rushed, but I also think it kind of fits within like the framework of it.
Sure. Yeah, I suppose I was a little critical of the dragon because like I've been doing a lot of reading of like classic literature lately, like novels, like American and British novels. So like I've been very critical of the overall structure of a story. So like to see the dragon thrown in when I was rereading it for the recording, like everything was perfectly resolved by the end. And then just the dragon showed up and I was like, what the hell's going on? You know,
I don't think you're off base. I mean, I think it's totally fair criticism. He's definitely a little bit tacked on. I find him such an endearing goofball.
I agree. I actually forgot he was as cool as he was. He's a cool dragon is what he is. He's not very threatening, but he's a cool dragon.
Yeah, he's got a very weird character design. Honestly, his character design is kind of like nothing else that Barks has done.
Yeah, totally.
And then, you know, the whole thing has this very retrograde attitude towards women that obviously does not work well these days, but if you just kind of consume it as an artifact of its time, I'm never gonna like that stuff because it always feels a little bit lazy. But I get where he's coming from. There are still some fun elements there in like the ridiculous over the top cooking dishes, you know. I think there's definitely a little element of maybe Barks still being bitter at his you know, he's into his third and successful marriage now, but I understand that his previous marriage ended pretty poorly. So it almost feels like an ex-wife story or something.
Yeah. No kidding. Actually, that makes a lot of sense now, looking at this story and when it was written.
Right. So let's talk a little bit about the general consensus. This is a famous Barks story. This is probably like when people talk about Uncle Scrooge and Carl Barks stories, people probably mention this in the first 5 or 10, I'm guessing. Yeah. So it has a very high rating on Index, not like an all time, but you know, in one of those upper tiers. It is, as of when I looked, it was number 46. Out of all 42,000 or so stories, good for a 7.9 rating. And like, I have a lot of nostalgic, you know, love for this one, even if I have a couple problems with it. So like, despite the flaws, the things that work so well, I think that's a pretty fair rating.
Yeah, I agree. 8 out of 10 is pretty solid. I know people on Index who generally rank Bark stories are more forgiving than like you and I might be, who are talking about it for like an hour and a half for a podcast.
Right.
But no, 8 out of 10 is a good place to put it.
I mean, any story that's like, classic. Oh, go ahead.
I was just going to say, of course, it's like an actual treasure hunt, which if you think about it, Barks didn't do as many as those. I think that was sort of popularized because of Rosa. I think there are only like 7 actual Barks hunts for like, you know, like a treasure, like some gold thing. So yeah, you know, treasure hunts among Barks fans are a hot item. So naturally, yeah, gold leasing is sort of a big one.
Yeah, that's true. That's a good point. The actual treasure hunts are going to be iconic. I'll have to do a tally for the podcast because that's something I never thought about. Yeah, so people really like this one. DuckTales, of course, popularized the treasure hunts. And DuckTales did adapt this one. This was one of the like 20 or so stories that DuckTales did a pretty straight up adaptation of. Did you get to see it by chance?
I actually did not. I don't think I did.
So I don't know. I don't think that they did one for the second series, but for the first series, it was done, and it was titled The Golden Fleecing, exactly like it. And I gotta say, it was a pretty strong adaptation. It was kind of a Launchpad episode, you know, Launchpad instead of Donald. Mm-hmm. They briefly shoehorn Ludwig von Drake, makes one of, I don't know if he ever appeared in any other episodes, but he's like Launchpad psychiatrist, and Launchpad is worried that he's having these hallucinations because he saw the Larkies. So they don't really do any of that sort of mysterious setup, but there's again this sort of cooking competition element, and they want to feed him to the dragon at the end. But like when I watched the Lemming with the Locket adaptation recently and Back to the Klondike, I thought those were much weaker as far as Bark's adaptations go. So you know, I don't love most of the original DuckTales episodes, but this was a pretty good one. I think that one of the Larkies was voiced by June Foray, who is always great to hear.
That's very interesting.
I didn't fact check that. I'm just going by my perception, so I could be wrong. But yeah, this is not one that ever had, as far as I know, there was never like, Rosa didn't do like any kind of a sequel. He gave so many of the iconic stories the sequel treatment. But it was a little element of the like story called Rightful Owners by, what's that guy's name who did the video game? Warren Spector.
Oh, right? Yes. He
had a big story a few years ago where I think this was involved. And then I think Romano Scarpa used the Larkies again for some story that I've never read.
Oh, I don't. I'll have to look into that. I don't remember that.
Yeah. And as far as oil paintings, you know, Barks did do 2 oils for this one. One of them with the moment where they find the golden fleece. That's a very cool oil or litho or whatever. And then another one called Menace from the Myths, which focuses on one of the shrieking Larkies, which, you know, they're such a gruesome subject for an oil. It's a fun one, but I like the other one better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, his oils are always a treat to look at.
Yes, definitely. Let's see. I think that I got to say pretty much everything that I wanted to about this one, Austin. Do you have any other thoughts or comments or reflections?
I would say you covered it pretty well. It's a it's a pretty solid story. Even if we both had our critiques of it, I think it's still one of my favorites for that first half, especially.
Right. Yeah, definitely. Well, I really appreciate you joining me for this episode.
Anytime.
Let's see. People can check us out. Barks Remarks is on the usual socials. We got a Facebook presence and Instagram. And the next time around for the adventure length stories, we get to cover the very last of the Donald Duck adventures, The Secret of Hondorica. And Austin, I think you already highlighted the last bit of dialogue for us, but that's how I've been closing out the episodes the last couple of months. Do you mind reading that last panel again?
Sure. This doggone glittering golden Macintosh is the coldest contraption I ever had on my back.
Excellent. Thanks so much, Austin.
Anytime, yeah.
All right. I think that was great. I think that went really well.
Yeah, that was nice.
Thank you. And I will let you get to the rest of your afternoon and evening.
Cool. Yeah, I appreciate it.
Take care, Austin.
Thanks. You too. I'll see you around.